You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Firefighters Local 42 and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 124. The Greater Kansas City Firefighters Local 42 is an affiliate of the International Association of Firefighters. We are your firefighters, EMS professionals, communication specialists, prevention and logistical support members within the Greater KC Metro region. We support labor and labor education that is provided by this program. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We have been wiring Kansas City since 1905. And if you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEW124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. Thanks to our underwriters for their support for the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, 2 weeks ago, more than 2,500 grassroots labor activists, worker center leaders, union members, union officers, and the community activists and community activists gathered in Chicago for the semi-annual Labor Notes Conference. We're going to bring you some highlights tonight. Then, as labor gears up for the No on Proposition A campaign, we'll talk to Bill Fletcher Jr., former AFL-CIO education director, commentator, and author, about how to beat right to work. In the news, is Walmart bankrupting the city of Raytown? And the other NRA can't make its message on the minimum wage work with the public. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. She'll tell you whether or not you have a right to go to the bathroom at work. Now for the news.
This is the news from our side for April 19th, 2018. On Tuesday, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union and Making a Change at Walmart joined with Raytown residents to hold a press conference in front of Raytown City Hall to announce the results of a survey they conducted and the creation of Citizens for Public Safety Against Walmart Taxpayer Abuse Task Force in response to Walmart's excessive use of police resources and failure to sufficiently contribute to the city's general fund. Lucio Perez, who lives in Independence and is a member of the Cement Masons Local 518, said that Raytown has had to lay off 14 police officers and is in a budget crisis. Raytown resident Katie Phelan, who is co-chairing the task force with Lucio, made a comment.
We're here tonight because we are taxpayers and citizens of Raytown. There are now three proposals in front of the Board of Aldermen about proposed tax increases for the residents of Raytown to pay. A proposed property tax increase, a sales tax increase, and an internet user tax. At this time, there are no proposals for making Walmart pay their fair share, and the aldermen are refusing to look at any fee system or increase on taxes to make Walmart pay their fair share for services they disproportionately use. I called last week to request that the city of Raytown protect our children by sending a patrol car for 15 minutes after school at the middle school where there have been numerous fights. I was told that in order for that to happen, you would have to call on a daily basis as needed. And yet we have all of us seen police cars sitting out in front of Walmart in Raytown for hours on end. There were two bomb scares, and there were a lot of police and firefighters used for those bomb scares. Did Walmart have to pay? And the day I called to try to get the police to come out, there was a shooting at the school that night at a track meet. So this is an issue. I mean, they found it more important to be at Walmart than protecting our kids. And did Walmart have to pay for anything that they're getting from this city? You know, they have an abatement on their property taxes, you know, and it leaves the community members begging for services. I attended a meeting with two aldermen to discuss this issue, and the aldermen absolutely refused to take any proposals from us, pushed it away. They've been hostile and they've been dismissive. And tonight, we as citizens of Raytown will come together to ensure that Walmart, one of the most profitable corporations in America, pays their fair share for where they exist, instead of taxing the ordinary citizens of our community.
The group released the results of a survey of 200 residents of Raytown, which showed that 98% of those surveyed think Walmart should pay its fair share of city services. From November 2016 through October 2017, Walmart generated 812 calls for city services. When faced with a budget shortfall last year, Raytown briefly considered holding Walmart financially accountable for its excessive police service calls, but instead cut the police budget and other public services. The root of the problem goes back to 2007. Raytown used TIF, or tax increment financing, a form of subsidy, which left taxpayers on the hook for $40 million in bonds plus interest. Most of that money was used to acquire land for and build the new Walmart Supercenter. However, none of the annual sales or real property taxes for the Raytown Walmart store has ever been available to fund the city's budget. Instead, taxes are redirected to bond payments. This year alone, Raytown will spend roughly $3 million on the bond payments, of which an estimated $1.8 million will primarily come from taxes generated by Walmart that would otherwise have been available to fund the city's budget.
The other NRA, that's the National Restaurant Association, commissioned a survey from a top Republican pollster to find out if people would pay more at restaurants if the minimum wage were raised to $10 an hour, and got an answer they didn't want. The poll, which was presented on a slide scale obtained by The Intercept, found out that 71% of Americans want to see the minimum wage raised, even if it means that they have to pay more for meals. It also found that the industry's various talking points against raising the wage are mostly falling flat with the general public. The NRA is a trade association for the massive restaurant industry. Increasingly, the survey also revealed that while 62% of Americans have confidence in local restaurants, only 9% do in the NRA. The restaurants industry is huge. The NRA claims that the industry in the United States is now larger than 90% of the world economies. The NRA's CEO, Don Sweeney, was paid more than $3.8 million in total compensation a few years ago. That would put her hourly pay at $1,867.88 per hour. The NRA has long claimed that increasing the minimum wage would ratchet up restaurants' labor costs and result in thousands of lost jobs. But these results show that the NRA's rhetoric on minimum wage is failing to move the American public. Indeed, as Democrats embrace the $15 an hour wage ahead of the 2020 presidential campaign, the NRA is moving in the opposite direction.
If you're from Chicago, you know that the Chicago Tribune was always a staunchly anti-labor paper. Indeed, after the Haymarket incident, it called for the hanging of the supporters of the eight-hour day movement. So it's quite a surprise that today's Tribune employees are unionizing. News service, PAI, reports that the Chicago Newspaper Guild, CWA, officially announced an organizing drive at the Chicago Tribune. No election date has been set. Recently, the Trib was purchased by a newspaper holding company called Trunk from Sam Zell, a real estate magnate who had milked it into bankruptcy. Trunk then tried unsuccessfully to buy Chicago's other big paper, the Sun-Times, which is unionized, in order to shut it down. However, they were outsmarted by a syndicate headed by a wealthy local Democratic alderman and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Trunk appears to care little about the quality of the paper or its staff. They also own the LA Times, which they provoked into unionizing then and then sold. Now they've pushed the Tribune staff, and they formed an organizing committee of 46 and issued an open letter to their colleagues asking them to join the union. The Trib is the fifth paper so far this year to try to organize. The News Guild president Bernie Lunzer said, "There's an uprising among journalists, a fight for the heart and soul of the profession." The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, Michael Savoir, and myself, Chris Mann.
It's drastic time for sure. We need an antidote and a cure. Cause do you really think Muhammad got a problem with Jehovah? We don't want war. Imagine if every prophet was alive. And current days amongst you and I. You think they would view life like you and I do? Or could it sit and contemplate on why do we live this way?
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Chris Mann, and I'm hosting this program. The intro you've just heard was Black Eyed Peas' Union Song. Tonight, we will listen to Heartland Labor Forum contributors Michael Savoir and Mary Aereo. Michael and Mary traveled to the fabulous semi-annual Labor Notes Conference, which was held in Chicago on April 6th to the 8th of this year. For our listeners who have not experienced one of these conferences, Labor Notes was started in 1979 to combat increasing assaults on the rights of unionists. It's a gathering place for union activists who want to put the movement back into the labor movement. Labor Notes promotes organizing and other aggressive strategies to fight, as well as promoting alliances with allies. They sponsor conferences, author books, and hold workshops. Their website is labornotes.org. First on our program is Heartland Labor Forum programmer and longtime Teamster activist, Michael Savoir. Michael, welcome to your favorite spot on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Indeed, Chris. Thank you.
So, Michael, how long have you been going to Labor Notes conferences, and why do you continue going?
Well, not to reveal my age, but it's probably been at least 30 years, if not 33. I think my first Labor Notes conference was in 1985.
Okay. And for you this time, what was the most significant highlight of the conference, and why did you?
Well, a lot of observations, Chris. This is probably the biggest Labor Notes conference I've been to. Approaching 3,000 in attendance. One of the most interesting things, for the first time, it seemed that there were more women than men. Now, that's not necessarily significant, but it's, to me, it means that more people are getting involved across the spectrum. As kind of a senior person, I'm quite accustomed to the old-timers being the majority. Certainly the majority this time were young people. And so you might call it the Donald Trump effect. In other words, Donald Trump has encouraged folks to get involved in their civic and social responsibility. Probably the highlight of the conversation, if you can call, you know, one highlight, was the solidarity of the West Virginia school teachers. As you know, most recently had a statewide strike, not just to increase wages, but to increase working conditions. Teachers in West Virginia, probably like so many others, haven't had a wage increase in over 10 years. But that wasn't the most significant thing. What is the most significant thing is that these folks have had increasingly kind of challenges with working conditions, particularly their co-pays and health and on and on. So all in all, this was probably the highlight, their solidarity and how they work to get everyone involved in their industry in opposition to the challenges that West Virginia was provided.
And can you give us a 10-second sampling of other workshops? You said there was 300.
Yeah, I bet there were 300 workshops. I did a workshop on pension. Of course, as you know, we're fighting this national effort to undermine pension security nationwide. That was one of the other issues. There were so many, Chris. I don't think we may have to do another workshop on this.
Okay.
Or another radio show.
Okay. Well, thank you, Michael, mm-hmm. for coming to tell us about
mm-hmm.
it.
Indeed. You're very welcome.
Okay. So it's time to shift gears now, and we want to talk about one of our feature writers, which is Mary Aereo. Mary delivers the Safety First messages monthly on the Heartland Labor Forum. Mary went to the Labor Notes Conference and interviewed Jordan Barab, Health and Safety Director for AFSCME, and Steve Mosier, a retired director for Health and Safety, of the Retail Wholesale Department Store Union in New York City. Her interviewees, and Mary interviewed these folks, and the people she interviewed had the audacity to say that health and safety in the workplace is a human right. So let's listen to those interviews.
Hi, this is Mary Aereo for Safety First at the Labor Notes Conference, April 6th in Chicago, Illinois. I have the pleasure to meet with Jordan Barab, author of the Confined Space Newsletter, Deputy Secretary of Labor during the Obama administration. He ran the Health and Safety Program at AFSCME, along with many, many other health and safety responsibilities. Jordan Barab, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thank you, Mary. Glad to be here.
Jordan, the Confined Space Newsletter has been an important source of news for my Safety First. You say in your newsletter that you have found writing much more worthwhile if people actually read it and act on it. Are people really reading it, and what kind of response do you get?
Well, I think people are reading it. I know there are a lot of journalists who are reading it, and there's a surprising amount of interest among journalists in what's happening in our workplaces today, especially around health and safety. I know also I have a lot of people reading it who work in dangerous workplaces and want more information, and unfortunately people whose loved ones had died in the workplace. Every week I do a list of workers that I found who have been killed in the workplace over the last week, and I frequently hear from their loved ones thanking me for recognizing them, asking me for more information about the hazards that killed them, and wanting to know what they can do to make sure that nothing like that ever happens again.
On Saturday, you're leading a workshop on workplace health and safety in the Trump era. In this first year, what is your opinion on this so-called regulatory reform?
Well, Trump has made so-called regulatory reform a major priority. Again, under the typical Republican myth that regulations kill jobs. Well, OSHA regulations or OSHA standards are nothing more than worker protections, and anybody that wants to take those away is basically taking away protections from workers. There's no real evidence that regulations cost jobs. And actually, this administration hasn't done a whole lot to repeal OSHA regulations. There were two regulations that were repealed by Congress right at the beginning, one that dealt with record keeping, which will hurt because it'll hurt OSHA's ability to enforce accurate record keeping, and another one that dealt with health and safety with government contractors. But they have not been successful in rolling back regulations such as OSHA silica regulation, mainly because OSHA did a good job at it. The courts have upheld it already. And just as it takes many, many years to issue a new OSHA regulation, it takes many, many years and a lot of work to repeal one. And I don't think they see those efforts as being successful. One thing that we're, you know, that will hurt workers is it's unlikely that they're going to move forward on any new regulations. And OSHA has a few important ones in the process, one that covers infectious diseases, workplace violence, and health and safety in chemical plants. We don't see any of those probably moving forward in this administration.
I understand they have done some rollback on the beryllium standard.
They're trying to roll back some of the beryllium protections. They're keeping the standard, most of the standard in place, but they are proposing to roll back protections for construction workers and for maritime workers who use coal slag, which contains beryllium, to do abrasive blasting. So they're proposing to weaken that, and we'll just have to see what happens there. And needless to say, the unions representing those workers are strongly opposed to that. And even, quite frankly, the regulated community is not all that opposed to the regulation. It's mostly the people that sell coal slag that are opposing it.
And also, I read in a recent confined space about very small fines from OSHA being levied on communication tower fatalities.
Yeah, it's hard to say. There was just an incident where OSHA issued very small penalties to a company where three workers were killed after falling 1,000 feet from a communication tower. Communication towers are highly dangerous places to work. There are a lot of workers that fall and get hurt and are killed. I think the most important thing, as I mentioned, in terms of OSHA not moving forward on standards is we're getting ready to do a standard on communications towers. That is still on OSHA's agenda, but they're not even planning to do even the first step until next year. So even the standards they're moving forward on, like this important one, they're moving extremely slowly. And Trump, you know, committed to repealing two standards for every one that the agencies issue. So the question is, even if they do issue a standard that protects communication workers, what workers are going to have their protections lost under Trump's executive order?
In confined space, you dedicate a page on how to contact our senators and congresspeople. Do you think this is effective?
I do think this is effective. I mean, right now they probably hear a lot more from companies who complain that OSHA is hurting their business. So I think it's extremely important for them to also hear from workers who talk about how important health and safety is in the workplace, how dangerous their working conditions are, how important it is to have a strong agency like OSHA policing the worksite, and how OSHA needs much more funding and much more ability to issue standards and regulations than it has now, instead of cutting back on the agency. They don't hear enough from workers.
Right. And where can we find the Confined Space newsletter on the internet?
Well, it's easy to find. It's jordanbarab.com. That's my name. You can find it there. You can also sign up to get whatever I write by email. There's a comment section. I'd love to hear from people who have read things and have things to say about it.
Right. Anything else you want to add?
Well, I think, you know, it's just important, and one of the reasons I'm writing this is to really make the connection between our political scene and what happens in the workplace. I mean, to a very large extent, how people vote in this coming November's election or in the November elections 2 years from now determine to what extent, what chance they have of coming home alive and healthy in the workplace. The people they elect are very important to determine the protections that workers have in the workplace.
Jordan Barab, thank you from Safety First and the Heartland Labor Forum.
You're welcome.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First. Here at the Labor Notes Conference on April 8th, 2018, I'm meeting with Steve Mosier, retired health and safety director, retail, wholesale, department store, Union, New York City. Steve, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thank you very much.
Steve, you spoke yesterday at the workshop on health and safety about strategies that unions can use to improve health and safety. What are some of those strategies?
I think one of the biggest strategies is building the internal capacity. Health and safety is a human right, and I define health and safety, and I think unions should very broadly. It is any condition that people encounter at work that impacts on their health or their safety. So that means things like bullying, sexual harassment, wage theft, all kinds of issues that aren't traditionally thought of as health and safety issues. And I think in doing this, you reach out to a lot of people who would be interested in the power of a union. The power of the union really rests on the fact that it is a group that's going to back you up. And especially with health and safety, with what's been happening in terms of, you know, management's campaign to discourage people from reporting injuries, discourage people from being active, it's very important for workers to know that they have someone backing them up. There's a structure to protect them, to increase the powers that they may have under OSHA. Now, OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, is only part of the health and safety picture. And I think unions, there are lots of standards that OSHA doesn't have. OSHA's completely understaffed, always has been. So I think it's very important for unions to take a very active role on health and safety. That means using the power of the union, doing concerted action, filing grievances, writing contract language. These are all really important things. Filing a grievance on a health and safety issue is likely to be resolved better and more quickly than waiting around for OSHA to make an inspection.
Right. Can health and safety be an effective issue to use in organizing new workers?
Oh, I think absolutely, because, again, health and safety is a human right. People do not expect to go to work and be injured. In fact, a few years ago, an anti-union law firm did a survey, and they wanted to know why would workers want to join a union. And even above wages and benefits was health and safety. Health and safety was mentioned more often than anything else. The people believe that a union provides them some protection so that they go home to their family at the end of the day without serious injury. Now, we've used it several times. Let me just mention two situations. The organizing drive, people didn't know about the chemicals they were working with, and we talked about, you know, their rights to that, and that the union had a health and safety department. The union would be there to provide information and support on any issue that they had about their health and safety. Another situation had, we represented a lot of people who work in the South in poultry plants. And of course, it's always been right to work in the South. And we had training programs where we taught people about health and safety, about things that they were exposed to. And a lot of people who hadn't been in the union, because it was up to them whether they wanted to join or not, saw that this wasn't just something, oh, the union is only about collecting dues. The union is providing me important information, and they're providing a service, and therefore I want to join the union.
Do you have any other examples or anything else you want to add?
Just to emphasize the point that given what's going to happen, OSHA's, we like OSHA, it's important, but OSHA's, don't think of health and safety only in terms of OSHA. Think about talking about health and safety concerns, sharing the information as much as you do about other issues at work, building a strength within your union and working together once you identify problems to take concerted action to improve them. And, you know, sticking together and being strong is the way that you're going to take care of health and safety issues. And communicate. If you have already a committee or a group, be sure that you communicate about the issues, because sometimes people think, oh, the health and safety committee just talks about things, but nothing ever gets resolved. You know, talk about your successes. Share that information and share how important it is that people work safely.
We are out of time for tonight, for this part of the show. So the message from tonight is to go to the next Labor Notes conference. Thanks to Mary Aereo and Michael Savoir for making the trip to Chicago and then telling us about it. As Steve Mooser says in his interview, build strength within your union and stick together. Thank you for listening.
KKFI depends on its volunteers to make it a vibrant and vital resource to the Kansas City community. During National Volunteer Week, KKFI wishes to thank those volunteers who have kept us on the air for 30 years. Volunteers, thank you.
That's a wrap.
Stared at the sign on the door that read gone. Through the window he spied his old seat. Scratched at the back of his neck like he does. Wondered, now where will I eat? Every morning for years he'd nursed his black coffee and leisurely picked at his plate. Devoured the paper, heard all the latest they knew to expect him by 8. He looked up and down the small street for a moment. The storefront sat shuttered and locked. Turned up his collar, his hands in his pockets, and hungrily trod down the block. Oh, he'd heard of that new place, the one with the lights and a window that served folks in cars. Pushed through the doorway, hoping this might be where some of the regulars are.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. Bill Fletcher Jr. is one of the few well-known people today in the labor movement who is both an intellectual and a practitioner. He's held top staff positions in the AFL-CIO and other unions, and his books have served to stimulate thought among novices and hardened activists both. When he speaks, he always gives you something to make you uncomfortable in your certainties and to leave you mulling over new ideas. If you haven't read They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions, or Solidarity Divided, then treat yourself to a feast of ideas. So, as Missouri enters a summer of intense polarization over so-called right to work, which labor is simply calling Proposition A with a big fat no in front of it, I thought it's time to get some wisdom about how to fight the right-wing agenda from Bill Fletcher. And he was kind enough to give us some time.
Welcome to the show, Bill. Let's start with your definition of right to work. What is it?
Right to work is a very brilliant PR stunt that was put together by ultra-conservatives in the 1940s as a way of convincing the public that being in a union was somehow contrary to democracy and free choice, freedom of choice. It was also something that, and this is something that a lot of people aren't aware of, was crafted in the South and the Southwest explicitly on racial terms. In other words, the architects of right to work, particularly a guy named Vance Muse, had an explicit racial message to white workers that they should support right to work because otherwise they will find themselves in unions with black people and have to call black people brothers and sisters. Now, as extreme as that may sound, that's actually, it's documented. So that's the roots of this, and right to work has nothing to do with freedom of choice. It really is actually appealing to greed.
And it also is, as you've just illustrated, extremely divisive within the workforce itself, right?
Completely, because basically what it's doing is it's saying that unions should be the only institution in the country that has that have a statutory obligation to represent people and not receive any compensation to cover the cost of that representation. An example, the analogy that I always give is this. I want, you know, your listeners to stop and think of any town, village, city, or state in the United States where taxation is voluntary and where, at the same time, you get free police, fire, water, sewer, and education. It doesn't exist. Everyone knows just such a thing doesn't exist. But what happens in right to work is that you will have a situation where an individual worker can choose not to pay to help to cover the cost of representation, yet the union is obligated to represent them, which means that they have to use the money of the honest dues payers. It's completely absurd.
Until 2010, we actually contained pretty much the right-to-work states. Yes, Oklahoma passed right-to-work in the early 2000s, but there wasn't gaining traction in states across the Mason-Dixon line, so to speak. But now, since 2010, we've seen Michigan, Wisconsin, West Virginia, Indiana, Kentucky, all go right to work, and now Missouri is threatening to. So what's changed, and why is it back in such force?
There's a few reasons, Judy. One is, and probably the most important, is that as the trade union movement has weakened, this has opened up a means for the right to work forces to come forward. And so as opposed to in years past when you'd have states like Michigan that were very heavily unionized, as the unionization rate in these states weakened, so too did the pro-union sentiment in those states. So that's one thing. The second thing is that we're also reaping the results of a very long-term ideological offensive by the right wing. And I point to the era of Reagan as a critical point because it was during that era that the notion that people should only pay for what they need and what they get became a very prominent slogan of the right. It became a way that the right wing argued against taxation. They would say, for example, you shouldn't pay for public education if you don't have kids in public school. It's that sort of appeal to selfishness. Well, that ended up not just staying in the sphere of taxation, but it started spreading into other things. It's this appeal to selfishness, this idea that we should not care about our sisters and brothers, we should only care about ourselves, which obviously comes back and bites us in the rear when we actually need help from others. But it became very persuasive. So that grew over time as part of the growth of the right, because 2010 was the year of the dramatic midterm elections when the Tea Party forces accelerated their push for power.
So what do you think are their major objectives today? For instance, say Missouri goes right to work and we lose this referendum that's going to take place either in August or November. We still don't know. What are they going to gain by making Missouri another right to work state?
Well, the objective is the annihilation of unions, and they're very clear about that. The objective is the annihilation of unions, and what they gain from the annihilation of unions is the weakening of any force among workers that can fight for and push for justice. So the idea would be that when you weaken the unions, when the unions have fewer resources to do organizing, representation, political action, whatever, then the corporate America can just simply stomp on workers and walk straight through. That's what their aim is, and it's amazing. Now they hide it with a lot of fancy rhetoric.
Right.
They'll talk about freedom of choice, that somehow right to work would enhance a worker's freedom of speech. Well, that's bogus. There's nothing about being in a union that restricts your freedom of speech. You can be in a situation, as you well know, where a union takes a certain position on a political candidate, on an issue, and as a union member, you're not obligated to support that view, but it is the view of the majority, and as it should be. So there is no restrictions on freedom of speech. That is basically just a red herring in order to convince people that right to work is part of truth, justice, and the American way.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we're seeing in the attacks on voting rights and the threats to democracy that, in fact, the right wing actually doesn't believe in democracy, doesn't believe in majority rules. So is this just another example of that, do you think?
Yeah, I think that it is, that this is a further attempt to consolidate the hold that the wealthy have over this country. You see, one of the things that they recognize and that we don't actually talk enough about is that unions represent a major feature of democracy. Because what unions do, among other things, is that they block the unbridled control that employers have over the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
The workplace in a non-union setting is fundamentally totalitarian. And it's something that very few people talk about. When you're in a non-union workplace, you essentially, once you enter through the doors, you are giving up a whole set of rights. When you're in a non-union workplace, you have no freedom of speech. You have no freedom of the press. You have no freedom of association. You are under the thumb of the owner. And people frequently don't think about that because when you think about it in those terms, you might decide that you need to do something about it. But that's the setting that corporate America wants to impress upon us all.
Mm-hmm.
So right to work becomes a mechanism to do that. And it plays, I mentioned before about playing to greed. And this is the thing that we have to really understand, that what right to work is saying to individual workers is that you can take the risk of not paying dues or not paying an agency fee because somebody else will pay. And therefore, even though you're not paying anything, you're going to be guaranteed representation. But that's a very, very dicey risk. Because if in effect everybody says that, then the union collapses because the union will not have the resources in order to be able to conduct organizing and representation.
Right.
People that are pushing right to work know that.
Right. Yeah. And currently, of course, we're seeing a pushing of right to work in the public sector, too, with the Janus case, which
that's
is
right.
in the Supreme Court. But that's a whole other topic. I want to talk about Missouri. So we're talking to Bill Fletcher, Jr., about right to work. And you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Currently, labor did an enormously powerful job of collecting signatures on an initiative petition to repeal the right to work law that was passed in the 2016 legislative session. that is going to go to the voters either in August or in November. We won't know until the end of the legislative session. They're waiting to let people know so that, of course, we have a weaker campaign against Right to Work. And now if they end up getting rid of the governor, that might even stall it even longer. Who knows? It's a pretty dicey place right now in Jefferson City. So we have several months with which to convince the voters of Missouri that they need to vote no on the right to work, which is Proposition A. How do you think they should do this?
Well, you know, Missouri had a right to work campaign back in, 1978, if I'm not
mistaken.
Right,
that's correct, yes.
And that effort at right to work was defeated. And it was the effort to defeat it was led by Jerry Tucker, then a prominent leader in the United Auto Workers. And one of the things about any successful effort to defeat right to work is that you have to make the argument at the level of economic justice. You can't make the argument at the level of we've got to protect these institutions that are called unions, partly because most workers are not in union, but second and more importantly, the aim of right to work is to weaken efforts at economic justice. Now, that means that whether someone is in a union or not in a union, they have an interest in economic justice. I mean, once upon a time when you had a significant percentage of the workforce that was unionized, people that were not unionized would often benefit because their employers would understand that if they didn't treat their workforce better, there was a very good chance that there would be unionization. And there were patterns that were set that helped to raise the living standard of workers all over this country. As unions have weakened, that whole notion has gone out the window, and our living standard has declined. There's a direct correlation between the decline of unions and as a percentage and the decline in the living standard of the average U.S. worker. The right-to-work forces want that to continue. That argument needs to be made to the broader public. So people have to understand what really is at stake there, and that means a broad campaign. It means reaching and developing allies that are outside of the workplace, you know, community-based groups, religious institutions, et cetera. And there'll be different reasons that people will tend to gravitate towards a campaign to defeat right to work. Many religious institutions will immediately get the moral aspect of this and understand the immorality behind those that are pushing right to work. There will be community-based groups that will understand the impact of a further decline in the living standard. And so the unions need to be reaching out very broadly in this and to turn the effort to defeat right to work into an effort to promote economic justice. And one final thing about that is that we then have to become proactive. And becoming proactive, among other things, seems to me to involve creating a situation where workers actually have rights at work. And what that means, by way of example, is that we should have, all workers should have a guarantee of just cause before they're terminated. You know, right now, if you don't have a union or if you don't have a personalized contract, you can be terminated by an employer for any reason or no reason as long as it doesn't violate a statute like race, gender, religion. But other than that, an employer can get rid of you. So why isn't the union movement pushing so that in every state constitution, workers have basic rights at work, including just cause provisions before terminations? We've got to go on the offensive, and this defeating right to work can be part of that counteroffensive.
We've had discussions about that in Missouri Jobs with Justice talking about sponsoring an initiative like that for just cause and ending at-will employment in Missouri. I think it's a great idea. This year, we're trying to go on the offensive by increasing the minimum wage in Missouri, which will be on the ballot as well in November. Good. But thank you. Yeah, thank you for that advice. We have like 1 minute left, and I really wanted to ask you, what do you think labor gets wrong about white men? Because there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, the Trump voter, and there's been a lot of discussion about union members who voted for Trump. Just in a nutshell, what aren't they thinking about that they need to?
The leadership of organized labor thinks that if you talk with white workers, white men in particular, about what's going on, about issues of race, about the right wing, that you're going to scare them off, that they're going to run away screaming, having completely lost their minds. And I think that that's absurd. I think that if you actually link a discussion with history and you talk with white men about what's actually going on, we'll be able to win over millions. But you have to step away from cowardice.
Okay. Thank you. That was in a nutshell. We've been talking to Bill Fletcher, and I want to thank you very much, Bill, for being on the show. I think that you give us a lot of wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the law offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today we're going to be talking about something that's been in the news lately. The other day I was reading an article about workers at a certain plant that were afraid to take bathroom breaks and would often have to resort to using the restroom in bottles in order to not get in trouble. This led me to think, what exactly is the law related to bathroom breaks and breaks in general? So I thought we'd talk a little bit about that today. Once I started Googling this, I was astonished to see the number of articles related to people and their jobs policies related to bathroom breaks. Article after article discussed people in every employment line, from warehouse workers to factory workers to agricultural workers to discussing their issues with bathroom breaks. I found one article that said many poultry workers are resorted to wearing adult diapers and not drinking liquids in order to avoid being punished for using the restroom. So I started looking at what exactly is the law related to these issues. Sadly, I found that there isn't much. There is actually no law that requires your employment or your job to allow you to have any breaks at all, not lunch, not rest breaks, and not bathroom breaks. Now, most companies do allow these issues, but that doesn't stop it from being a big problem in some particular area. The first thing I found was OSHA. And OSHA is a federal organization, and OSHA does require that employers provide to employees toilet facilities and restrooms separated for men and women. The only guidance they really give is that employers may not impose unreasonable restrictions on the facility's uses, and employees should not take excessive amount of time in the bathroom and notify another employee of his or her absence. This would be an example where, like, you're working on a line or something and someone needs to fill in for you, or you're at, say, a retail organization and you're working as a cashier, someone might need to step in and cover your space while you go use. OSHA also states that employees will not suffer adverse health effects that can result if toilets are not available when employees need them. OSHA also designates a lot of restrictions, guidelines on where restrooms should be located. As a general rule, for example, one restroom is required for up to 15 employees, 6 facilities per 150 workers, and additional facilities for every 40 employees beyond. Additionally, restrooms should be placed no further than a quarter of a mile from where employees are actually working. So this would be especially important in, like, agricultural situations where people are working in fields and a long distance from, like, an actual. They're required to be single occupancy, include locks, have separated partitions. They're also required to have hand washing facilities, including soap, towels, or a dryer. However, that's generally where it ends. There's not any clear guidance on whether or not an employer can restrict bathroom use, other than the idea that employees should be given reasonable bathroom privilege. Now, what do you do if you feel like your job is unreasonably restricting bathroom privileges? This is where it becomes more difficult, because these are very case-by-case, very fact-specific. OSHA has declined to hear many bathroom break issues, but you also might find help in this case in the law of discrimination or under even the Americans with Disabilities Act. For example, if your need to go to the restroom is more frequent than someone else's due to some sort of medical condition, and the job is unfairly restricting your use, there may be a claim that you can make under a different area of the law, under either discrimination, if you feel like it's some sort of discriminatory action. For example, most of the things that I have read indicate that women a lot of times use the restroom more frequently than men. So if you think that it's a gender discrimination, you may have a claim related to gender discrimination or sex discrimination. If it's related to a medical condition, you might even have a claim under the Americans with Disability Act, because employers are also required to make reasonable accommodations for an employee's disability. This may include some kind of condition that necessitates that you use the restroom more frequently than perhaps others. All in all, this is a pretty interesting area, and if you feel like your job is having some issues with this, you ought to contact a lawyer that specializes in employment, so you can discuss your options. That's all the time that we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. This is, again, Angela Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Thanks, and be safe, Kansas City.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. This Saturday, April 21st, there's the Wyandotte County Democratic Breakfast, 8:15 for breakfast, 9 a.m. for the speaker. And the speakers are candidates for governor of Kansas, Laura Kelly, Dr. Arden Anderson, and State Representative Jim Ward. This will be at Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. Poor People's Campaign, civil disobedience training. There's one in Kansas and there's one in Missouri. The Kansas one is, they're both on April 28th. Kansas one is from 3 to 5 p.m. The Missouri one is from 3:30 to 5:30. For the Kansas one, you have to RSVP on Facebook. Go to Kansas Poor People's Campaign to find the listing. And for Missouri, it's at 3800 Troost. May Day Concert, Tuesday, May 1st, 6 to 11 p.m. at Revolution Records, 1830 Locust in Kansas City, Missouri. Honduras Resists the Empire, a talk by Karen Spring of the Honduras Solidarity Network, Tuesday, May 8th, 7 p.m., Rockhurst Community Center, 5401 Troost in KCMO. And Workers' Revival Festival, 2 days of music and art celebrating working class power, sponsored by Jobs with Justice and Blacksite Records, May 11th and 12th at the Record Bar in Kansas City, Missouri. And save the date, all you labor musicians and artists. The 2018 Great Labor Arts Exchange will take place on June 21st to 24th at the ATU Tommy Douglas Conference Center in Silver Spring, Maryland. For more information, go to laborheritage.org. You can find our calendar as well as our archived shows and our upcoming schedule at heartlandlaborforum.org. That's it for the show. Tune in next week. We're going to have Representative Judy Morgan on talking about this year's legislative session. And we're going to be talking about a book called The Life and Times of Lucy Parsons, American Radical. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zeman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.